Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
It's Monday, November 18th. From HBR2, it's The Conversation. With the current levels of medical technology and research, doctors can diagnose and treat illnesses once thought impossible. But has all this compromise been made in bedside manner? Stanford physician Abraham Verghese says yes, and he's working for change.
And growing up was never easy. Today we'll hear why one doctor says it's tougher now to meet the needs of kids. We'll talk with Dr. Leonard Sachs about boys adrift and girls on the edge, and why gender matters.
Just some of the conversation coming your way. First, this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning, Chris.
We just heard a story on the national news that kind of leads into your first conversation about the whole changing nature of gender identity, the dispute between Cheney's two daughters.
Right, and that is a family issue in their part, but some things that are far more, out there, as a matter of fact, are some of the questions that we've been asking over the last several weeks during the special session and some of the conversations we've had and will continue to have. But today we're going to talk about kids and specifically once upon a time when it was fashionable to think that kids were fungible. Kids were just kids, and as the thinking went, adults were the ones who somehow assigned roles to kids based on sex, and they could change outcomes by changing their parenting style to something that was more gender neutral. But now those kids are raising kids and confronted by what Dr. Leonard Sachs says is a crisis for girls and an epidemic of underachievement for boys. Dr. Sachs is in Hawaii to talk about both over the next two nights, and he joins us this morning. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
Parenting has gone through many evolutions over the last 50 years. Before that, it seemed to be reasonably constant. But then from the advent of Dr. Spock on and parents wondering how they could best do their jobs, it's led to a lot of push and pull in how we look at kids, how we look at girls versus boys, how we teach both. But would it be fair to say that somehow with what we've done up to this point, we've tried to be fair to both and enhance both and maybe not done such a great job for either?
Well, I think we would all agree that we want every child to fulfill their potential and that the whole world should be open both to girls and boys. And many have thought, well, the best way to do that is to pretend that there's no differences. And we've tried that now for well on 30 years, and it's not working. Ignoring the gender differences, pretending they're not there, has not given us a generation of boys who want to keep scrapbooks and talk about their feelings. It has not given us a generation of girls who want to be computer scientists and engineers. In fact, the proportion of American college students earning degrees in computer science who are female has dropped from 37% in 1980 to less than 20% in 2010. So on many parameters, we're actually losing ground.
Yeah, which is odd when you think about all of the attention that was given to getting girls involved with STEM education and specifically targeting girls for math, science-type careers and saying, have you thought about this? Have you looked at this? But it was more than just have you looked at, but really this is where you should go. And then that sense of, maybe that's not what an individual girl wants to do. It started to fulfill our ideas of what they should be again and not necessarily helping them to fulfill their own dreams.
Well, the irony is it's really backfired. Many, many girls, I think, would love engineering and computer science, but it's taught in a way that doesn't engage girls. The best way to get girls excited about computer science turns out to be different from the best way to engage boys. And there's good scholarship on this now. Caitlin Kelleher in University of Washington has found she can triple the proportion of sixth grade girls who want to spend their free time studying computer science if you teach it differently. But very few teachers have any training in those techniques.
Girls have had a lot of focus on them in the last particular 20 years. And in some ways, that's de-emphasized what we did for boys. Boys, as you mentioned, who don't want to go off and be on the debate team, or they don't want to be involved with doing anything that a generation or two ago might have been seen as a worthy pursuit. Why have we so also failed boys?
Well, it certainly wasn't intentional, but it has absolutely happened, and that'll be a big focus of what I speak about with the parents. That, you know, in 1977, I was invited to compete in a creative writing competition, and I wrote a story about East German refugees escaping to West Germany and stepping on a minefield and traumatic amputation and violent death, and I got the highest award for the National Council of Teachers of English. Last year at an American high school, a boy wrote a very similar story, and he was suspended from school. And the parents were told he can't return until they get a note from a licensed professional showing he poses no imminent danger to himself or to others. Boys doing things that boys have always done, writing stories about traumatic amputation or death, drawing pictures of swords, pointing fingers at one another, saying, bang, bang, you're dead. Boys doing things that boys have always done. Now gets you in trouble. And the result of that thoughtless intervention is that many boys now regard academic achievement as unmasculine, especially boys from affluent families. It's true in low-income neighborhoods as well, though. It really cuts across all demographics.
So we've managed to help them into yet even a lower echelon of their own self-esteem?
Well, it's not self-esteem that concerns me. It's the fact that so many boys today don't want to work hard to do well in school. It's uncool for boys to care about getting an A instead of a B. Boys are supposed to be concerned about athletics or about getting the next level in their video game. For American boys today, to be concerned about doing well in school is totally uncool. And I think that's ironic that this lack of awareness of gender differences, which was motivated by all the right intentions, has had the unintended consequence of disengaging boys from academic achievement.
At the same time, we've watched the rise of video games and technological play that allows them to engage with each other in a very different way than would have been possible even 10 years ago.
Well, boys still want to play the games that boys have always wanted to play. But if the school says, no, you can't do bang, bang, you're dead here, that's inappropriate. You can't draw a picture of a sword. You certainly can't write a story in which men engage in violent combat. Boys are like, all right, school's stupid. I'm going to go home and play video games, because the video games totally understand this. And that boy who might have been a very imaginative, creative writer is not writing. Instead, he's playing video games with his friends.
And the girls, because there was sort of a movement to get girls to be involved with gaming as a marketing ploy. But there are not a lot of girl gamers that I know who think that that's what they want to be doing with their lives, or who will choose that over something else that might be a little bit more attractive. But girls seem to be so anxious about so many things these days. Have we just given them one more thing to be anxious about with all this technology?
Well, this evening I'll talk to parents about how Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, that we've now got good scholarship, which I'll present, showing that the more time a girl spends on social media, the more likely she is to become anxious or depressed. But that, curiously enough, seems to be true only for girls, not for boys. And we'll explore why is that so, and what do parents need to know about it?
Well, a lot to be talking about with parents both tonight and tomorrow night. Thanks for stopping in with us.
Thanks again.
Dr. Leonard Sachs is the author of Girls on the Edge and Boys Adrift. He provided both primary and urgent care services to kids and adults in suburban Maryland for more than 19 years. His sabbatical will end soon. He'll return to his full-time clinical practice in January. And tonight, he'll be talking about girls, and tomorrow night about boys. Both lectures are at Tenney Theater. Details are on hpr2.org. This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:15. Coming up, bigger kids getting it right, at least in the band room, and bigger costs at the Capitol for the special session. Now, get ready. It's time for a trip to the backyard.
Umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, ohavai.
In today's backyard quiz, we're looking for the name of the last Hawaiian princess. She was famous for her beauty and grace and is remembered as a talented artist and musician who loved to swim and ride horses. She'd been named heir apparent to Queen Liliuokalani and worked hard to restore the monarchy after her aunt was overthrown. She took her case directly to President Grover Cleveland, who sympathized, but Congress refused her petition. Her childhood friend, Robert Louis Stevenson, called her, quote, "The island maid, the island rose, light of heart and bright of face, the daughter of a double race. Can you name her? Post your answer on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, and we'll tell you who got it right in the next half hour."
Aloha, I'm Lavore Addison from the University of Hawaii at Manoa, studying theater. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HI Conversation.
Now on to more modern student musicians. For student ensembles, today holidays are not only a time to make a joyful noise, they're a time to mount the most challenging and elaborate productions of the year. It's also the season for ensembles that practice and perform separately to get a chance to take the stage together. Joe Roskowski is the director of the Hawaii Pacific University Band, just teaming up with HPU's International Vocal Ensemble and Chorale and its Symphony Orchestra for a free winter concert this Friday. The concert is In Dulci Jubilo, Joy to the World, and Joe's with us in our studio.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good morning. Holiday music is regardless of denomination, is about joy and celebration, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. There's something about it and the history of it that just, you know, it changes people. It affects them differently. Psychologically, it puts them in a different mood and gets them ready to long and look forward to something.
Well, you know, you hear something like Beethoven's the chorale movement, Ode to Joy. And although the words are in German, you hear that piece of music and it evokes joy regardless of your culture, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I just got chicken skin as you said that. Just when you said the chorale section of the Ninth Symphony, it instantly happens because it's the joy and the wonderfulness of it. I think that goes beyond any language and transcends any culture.
But, you know, Joe, it's just notes, right? How,
yes.
What is it that, you know, why is it so clearly, you know, I mean, obviously, this is a great genius realizing his intention, but what makes that work?
Well, you know, that's the wonderfulness of aesthetic value, isn't it?
Sure.
Something
is.
That it's very difficult to put a finger on, and it's very difficult to put a price on unless you're selling artwork at Sotheby's. But yeah, there's just something about it that I think each individual person takes into their heart and into their mind and interprets it for themselves and just gives it this incredible value. And that value is not bound by anything more than what it is.
Are there emotions inherent to certain chords, certain notes, certain rhythms? I mean, you know, can you make it a science out of it?
Well, whenever anybody says that, I always think of the famous line from Spinal Tap where he's playing his music. He's saying, "I'm playing this in D minor. It's the saddest of all keys. It just makes people weep instantly." That's a difficult thing to say.
I was just going to mention D minor. I didn't realize it was in Spinal Tap.
Oh, absolutely.
That's funny.
You know, it's the same as A being a good country key. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure if I dig deep enough, I can find you a couple research studies that says, oh, yes, indeed, this is how it actually physically works. works.
But I guess if we had it down to a science, then anybody could do it.
Yeah, it's like surfing big waves. If anybody can do it, our grandmothers would be out there, wouldn't they? Yeah, it's something to that, isn't it?
What governed the choice of the music that you guys picked for this show?
Well, yeah, you know, we call it our winter concert, but it's actually taking place on Friday, November 22nd. That's even before Thanksgiving. Yes, this new holiday of, thanks, Christmas ka.
Yeah.
I kind of look at it, you know.
Right.
What governs the choice? Well, we kind of take a look at what are some of the holiday classics. What are music that are popular concert goers going to recognize? What are they going to look forward to? Mm-hmm. You know, are there certain holiday songs that people just like, wow, I'd really, really like to hear that. The band is going to play Greensleeves, a variation on Greensleeves, mm-hmm. which, I mean, Greensleeves, wow, that's almost 500. It's more than 500 yeah. years old. It was written in the 1580s, I believe. We choose music that people are like, wow, that's one thing that is nostalgic, but yet when I hear it, it makes me look forward to this holiday season and the holiday seasons to come.
Well, you know, Greensleeves is an old-timey piece that also was done by John Coltrane, right?
Oh, absolutely. That Greensleeves just, oh.
It can be done any number of ways, right?
Absolutely. And that's, I think, one of the great things about the music that we hear at the holidays is that it not only can it be done in so many different ways, it has been done in so many different ways. And we know in the future it will be done in so many different ways.
You know, when music is connected to ceremonial occasions and rituals, be they religious or any secular or tribal, any kind, it kind of is taking music to its birthplace, don't you think, in a sense?
Wow, a birthplace and beyond. Because, yes, the idea of the ritual of music goes back to probably the earliest human communications, where we sang as part of a ritual, either a social ritual or purely communicative ritual that mm-hmm. we had to do in order to survive.
But somehow it seems as if every culture turns to music, particularly vocal music, when things are really important or when something really important needs to be said, yeah?
Oh, absolutely, because everything goes back to vocal music. No matter what we're doing on a violin or a trumpet or a drum, it's really just a recreation of what we are doing with our voice. And for many of us, the instrument must take place of the vocal instrument that we don't have. And that instrument is so important in human communications, the evolution of human communication, and just the basic human response.
When you teach, and you teach individual instruments as well as band,
yes.
yeah,
mm-hmm.
do you emphasize that? Do you kind of say we're all just wishing we could sing? Right?
Absolutely. I'll tell anybody this who puts an instrument in front of them, whether it's a piano or I teach trumpet mostly at HPU as mm-hmm. in addition to being a band director, and I tell my students that piece of metal that is in front of your face, that is nothing more than an amplifier for your voice, which is really an amplifier of your soul. Mm-hmm. And that's where it all really comes down to. I'm a horrible singer, Chris. I'll be the first to admit.
Hey, me too.
Well, that's why we play trumpet and guitar.
Exactly.
But I'll be the first person to admit it, but I'll also be the first person to say my musical instrument, my band instrument, is just the amplifier for the voice that I don't have. And it allows me to express what I want to express with my voice, which I can't, but what I'm really expressing with my heart and my soul.
It's the only musical instrument that is also a living being.
Oh, well, you know, that's probably one interpretation, but I know a lot of Hawaiian musicians who will tell you that their instruments are living beings as well.
Excellent point. Joe, great to have you on the show, as always.
Thank you. We hope you can make it to the concert on Friday night at 7 o'clock at
Absolutely.
Central Union.
Joe Ruskowski is the director of the Hawaii Pacific University Band that will combine with HPU's International Vocal Ensemble and Chorale and its symphony orchestra for a free winter concert this Friday called In Dulce Jubilo, Joy to the World. That's at Central Union Church. It's free on Friday night.
Getting into the pot business, as easy as running a Chuck E. Cheese?
Because we're the first ones doing it, no one has any idea what the size of the market is, how responsive the market's going to be to price.
Legalizing marijuana in Washington State raises the question of how to make weed a legit profession. Unintended consequences beyond the munchies. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
Support from Hawaii Public Radio station members makes it possible for HPR's broadcast services to reach more listeners around the state than ever before. We're proud to welcome William and Camilla Albert of Honolulu, Stephen Crisp of Kailua, and Wailea Roster of Honolulu to HPR's family of members. Thank you all for your recent gifts. Now, you can join the people who are making a difference through their support. Just click Support Hawaii Public Radio on HPR2.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting The Spoken World, with National Poetry Slam champion Mark Mammoothie Joseph in a choreo poem that examines hip-hop, global travel, and urban environmentalism. 7:30 Wednesday in Castle Theater. MauiArts.org.
Double the time might make you think that the cost doubled for the special session to legalize gay marriage in Hawaii, but no, according to Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair. The price was more than triple the estimate, but many state lawmakers generally agree it was money well spent. Chad Blair joins us now for today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So when we talked about the estimate, which was then about $26,000,
Yeah. It
was kind of dicey whether that would be, you know, the real cost would be contained within that figure. And clearly we saw that it wasn't. But any indication earlier on that it was going to be over triple the original estimate?
So that figure of $26,000, that's based on that the session would have lasted just 5 days, which is roughly what other special sessions have lasted. And where that money, that cost comes from is a per diem for neighbor island lawmakers, right? They got to fly over to Oahu. They have to have lodging. But you know what happened with Senate Bill 1 on same-sex marriage, those marathon hearings and floor sessions.
The bill where nobody went session. Home.
Oh, exactly. It couldn't leave, actually. Probably couldn't catch a plane after midnight either. And the session lasted longer than 2 weeks. So that pushed the total figure to $77,000 cost to taxpayers for the special session.
But when we talk about the money for it and what we had to be able to achieve this time around, there really wasn't going to be any way around that because people were going to testify and they were going to go as long as they had to go. And especially those we've talked to have said, particularly with this issue, wanting to bend over backwards to give people the opportunity to be there. Perhaps we should have just known that it was going to far overrun the costs and be prepared to do that. And wondering if some people had the idea that maybe somewhere above $75,000 was going to be more the real cost.
And by the way, we should point out that we haven't factored in the overtime for sheriff's deputies. Remember how they had all the security at the Capitol for the pro-gay marriage and anti-gay marriage groups? That figure won't be available for a couple of weeks, and when we get it, we'll be sure to publish it. One other thing, we didn't include all the volunteer time and staff that was really working far beyond their normal job requirements. If we added that in somehow, that cost would be even higher. Credit to Senate and House staff and others for sticking it out and helping to hear all those hours of testimony.
Again, the whole issue of wanting to bend over backwards to make sure that
Right. Everyone
could feel that it had been done and done well, and that in this case, the cost of democracy was money well spent.
I think so. We did talk to a couple of lawmakers, mind you, ones that were in favor of Senate Bill 1, who said, you know, we couldn't have done this during the regular session. It would have been a huge disruption. There are hundreds, thousands, really, of bills that get introduced. The only way to do it was a special session, and now it's over.
It is, and you're breathing a big sigh of relief, as are, I'm sure, many people who had to stay there for hours and hours and days. Thanks, Chad. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Beth Ann. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com. ¶¶
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And, Kathy, people are starting to figure out that smoking is bad for you, but there's still a ways to go, huh?
Well, there is, and we're going to talk today about the Great American Smokeout. And this includes not just people who use cigarettes, but we're going to touch on some of the new things like the electronic cigarettes and e-smoking devices and how those also can be harmful for your health and why we should include that in the recommendations to quit smoking.
Do people who smoke the e-cigarettes, are they kidding themselves a little bit?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, we know that most of the problems with cigarettes are the other toxins that are present in the cigarettes. But, you know, there still is a question about how safe is it to have continual nicotine exposure, which is what's in a lot of the e-cigarettes, and what is that going to do for your health? And we don't think it's going to be positive.
Well, nicotine's a poison, right?
Nicotine is a poison. Nicotine is addictive. Nicotine makes you crave whatever it is that has nicotine in such a strong fashion, it's often hard to resist.
And so, you know, these e-cigarettes, they're nicotine, they're in effect poison delivery devices, yeah?
Well, they are, and they were devised to help people who are addicted to the nicotine get away from those other chemicals that are in traditional cigarettes, but there's still some things in the e-cigarettes that may not be healthy for you. So we're going to sort of tease out the data. Why is it that we need to be worried about these things? And we're going to review the locations where you can't smoke, because it seems like that's increasing day by day, and we're going to talk about why that is.
Great. Sounds like a pretty valuable show, Kathy. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
Continuing a conversation about health, well, few of them these days stray from the impact of health care reform in our lives, how to balance the needs of patients and doctors and hospitals and insurers even as the ACA continues to morph and costs for care escalate, could often mean little time for anything but the technology. And there's plenty of it to go around and plenty of it in our lives anyway. So what's happening to the human element? Dr. Abraham Verghese is advocating for its rightful reinstated place in the patient-doctor relationship. He's in Hawaii for tomorrow's healthcare summit and joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethan. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, because that redefinition of relationship between patient and doctor has been undergoing so much change over the last many years that people feel lucky if they get a glimpse of their doctor for a couple of minutes, and then he or she may be off again.
I know, and that's the great paradox about healthcare, is that in many ways we've never had better health capability in terms of treating disease, and yet it's come with an increasing public disenchantment with what it's like to visit a physician. And I think that's because we forget that ultimately this is a human-to-human interaction. It's a very vulnerable person coming to another human being at a time of increased vulnerability and looking for something more than a transaction that revolves around lab tests and paradigms. They're looking at some level for the physician to be comforting them, saying at some level, you know, daddy, mommy, please help me, and getting that sort of nurturing. And I think in our postmodern self-consciousness, we've gotten very far away from that.
It's made it very easy to sort of discount that vulnerability by addressing it only with facts or with what we can do with tests and the technology that's been made available. But all of that seems to be pointing out the fact that we really need each other at a very deep level, and medicine has been none too quick to respond to that.
Yeah, I think, you know, we really have lost sight of the importance of the human connection. I actually believe that there's an important ritual that takes place. I mean, if you think about it, one stranger coming to another, telling them things that they wouldn't tell their rabbi or preacher or even their spouse, and then incredibly at the end of that, disrobing and allowing touch. And all this taking place in a strange room where one's wearing a white gown and another's wearing a paper gown, it has all the trappings of a ritual or a ceremony. And I think if you shortchange that ceremony, if you do a half-assed exam of the body and put your stethoscope on the gown and don't really listen properly, the patient walks away feeling that they were shortchanged in some way. So I think even as we use the best of technology, we have to sort of maintain that human connection that is so much a part of healing, so necessary.
Dr. Verghese, you just talked about what the patient may feel, but does a doctor also fall into that same risk of feeling that somehow there wasn't much of an exchange there, or are they just so beleaguered that they don't even have time to think about their own feelings?
I think it's very much a great part of the dissatisfaction among physicians is the sense that they're in this time-pressured, environment, and that for every 1 minute they spend with the patient, they have to spend 10 minutes recording the event on a computer. And they actually wind up spending more time on what I call the iPatient, which is the virtual construct of the patient and the computer, than they do on the real patient. And it's a source of great dissatisfaction. And I always think, why can't our technology now capture in real time the exchange between the patient and the physician so that we're not wasting our time being scribes and we can give all our attention to the patient without our eyes bouncing back and forth between a computer screen and the patient. But more than that, Beth, and I should say that the body is this incredible text that manifests all sorts of signs and all sorts of, signposts of disease. And what has also happened, embarrassingly, is that we are much, much worse than we were 100 years ago at picking up what I call the low-hanging fruit, the obvious manifestations of disease, which now we seem to not pick up because we're so dependent on the technology, so lost without our tests and our MRIs. And I think a better way to practice medicine, and this might feed well into the ACA and the healthcare reform that's coming, is to listen to the patient well, do a quick, thorough exam, pick up the low-hanging fruit, and judiciously order the right tests, rather than the approach we now have, which is, sort of a willy-nilly checking all the boxes and hoping that the answers fall out of the sky if you order enough tests.
Or hoping that somehow that'll cover your backside in case anything else were to shake out that you didn't perhaps pick up, or that maybe another doctor didn't. We've talked a lot about having all of patient records integrated electronically, being able to have patients be their own best advocates, all of those things in terms of disclosure and to talking about all of that. But still, in all of this, there's the sense that maybe patients are being sort of moved from pillar to post to get something done, as opposed to have a relationship with someone with whom they might be able to easily have that low-hanging fruit exposed, where they would be able to have a doctor say, well, remember the last time we talked?
Yeah.
Where there actually is a relationship there. It
Absolutely.
Seems to be, in many words, that word relationship is only talking about a visit, not necessarily something that extends beyond the time that you walk in a doctor's door.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. I think we're so caught up in the idea of healthcare coverage that we're not keeping in mind the necessity of a personal connection. And I must say, I'm so impressed with how far ahead you are in Hawaii in terms of the number of people who are covered, the number of people who have primary care physicians, the sort of not the over-dependence on the emergency room. So I think you're very poised here to do exactly what the rest of the country's trying so hard to do, which is to sustain and maintain one-on-one relationships, not just with a physician, but a healthcare team, but in a constant relational way over many, many years.
So how do you see changes happening in small ways? And we've talked a lot about beating over the head about what isn't, but you've been advocating very strongly for making those changes. How do you see them happening now in maybe smaller ways that we should sit up and take notice of?
Well, I think clearly the fee-for-service model is much threatened, if not in danger of disappearing. And we're going to be focusing much more on the collective health of a group of people. And we'll be measured by how well we do the job of taking care of our community. And the measures will include, above all, patient satisfaction. And I think to the degree that in this decade the buzzword is no longer quality of care, but has changed to patient satisfaction, I think we're going to hear from patients. I get lots of complaints from patients coming to me because I write about medicine. And it's so often the case that the complaint is phrased in the following manner, Bethan, which is, my doctor did not lay a hand on me. So-and-so did not touch me. It's interesting how often touch is expressed as the manifestation of this lack of care. And I think as we continue to hear these phrases and care about the patient reaction, I think we'll find ourselves bringing back the bedside exam, celebrating it not just for its ritual quality, but for allowing us to practice judicious, careful medicine and order tests selectively. So I think there's a movement afoot, and I'm very proud at Stanford that we're championing this, and I think it's taking hold.
Well, that's good news, and we'll end on that part. Thanks very much for coming to Hawaii. Thanks. I know that you're going to be speaking tomorrow, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Abraham Verghese is a best-selling author and prominent voice in medicine with a unique humanistic view of the future of healthcare, as you just heard him articulate. He's the Senior Associate Chair for the Theory and Practice of Medicine at Stanford, and his most recent novel, his other life as a novelist, Cutting for Stone, spent 2 years on the New York Times bestseller list. He'll be speaking at tomorrow's Hawaii Healthcare Summit and delivering a keynote speech called Marrying Technology with the Human Touch. We've got details on hpr2.org.
This is Amanda Stone, and this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
It's time for Stargazer. Aloha, I'm Dave Lawrence, and this is your weekly update of what's happening in our island skies and the world of astronomy. We're turning to Christopher Phillips of the Emilo Astronomy Center, our official connection to the Mauna Kea Summit, and we've got him on the line now. Hey, Christopher, aloha. What are some of the things we can be looking for in our week of stargazing, and where and when should folks be looking?
Hey, Dave, great to be back. So if you look into the west, Komohana, just after sunset, you'll be able to see the planet Venus still. It will remain visible in the evening sky till around about 8:45 p.m. And then 30 minutes after that, look over into the east, Hikina, because then you'll see Jupiter rising in the eastern sky. Now, Jupiter, like Venus, is very bright. On average, it's the third brightest object in the night sky after the full moon. So you folks out there with binoculars might even be able to see the four large moons of Jupiter through them. One thing to remember, people, is that the moon might not be at its fullest right now, but it's still very bright. And so spotting faint objects like stars, satellites, even the International Space Station is going to be very hard from the city, even under the clearest of conditions.
Anything unusual or island-related happening this week?
Now, normally at this time of year, I would tell folks to look out for the Leonid meteor shower. This comes from the direction of the constellation of Leo, which can be found in the south, Hema, at around 9 p.m. Normally, this meteor shower is pretty good, but the full moon, or Hoku moon, is going to make seeing it very difficult indeed. And as always with the Hoku moon, expect fair fishing, but murky waters.
And you had said there was something happening on the Mauna Kea summit you wanted to share with us.
Yeah, so big news from the Big Island recently. The Keck Observatory in Mauna Kea has confirmed the discovery of the first Earth-sized world detected around another star. Now, this is big news, because up until now, we've only been able to spot large planets in other solar systems. So astronomers here in Hawaii are really stepping up the game in terms of planet detection. Now, before you go packing your Ray-Bans and your slippers, you have to remember that this planet is so close to its star that basically what we're looking at is one big planetary barbecue. This place is hot. Definitely not a vacation spot in the future.
And Keck, tell us a little about the kind of equipment they use to discover it.
So Keck up on Mauna Kea is composed of two telescopes. Each one's roughly 10 meters across and is the most powerful pair of eyes on Mauna Kea right now.
Thank you for the heads up. We appreciate hearing about it. Christopher Phillips, Emilo Astronomy Center on the Big Island.
You're welcome, Dave. Good to talk to you.
You too, brother. And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next time here on Stargazer.
It's now coming up to 8:47 and time to take a look at our backyard quiz answer. Today we asked you for the name of the young woman who was heir apparent to the throne of Hawaii at the time the monarchy was overthrown. She was known on the mainland U.S. and in Europe as an eloquent representative of the kingdom. She'd been educated in Europe, was fluent in French and German, as well as English and Hawaiian. And following the overthrow, she took her case and that of her people to the nation's capital, saying, "I'm coming to Washington to plead for my throne, my nation, and my flag. Will not the great American people hear me?" Well, some did, but not enough to sway Congress. She returned to Hawaii in 1897, and there are several versions of what happened to cause her health to rapidly decline, But 2 years later, Crown Princess Kaiulani was dead at age 23. And that's our backyard quiz for today. And thanks to Samantha Sheehan, who posted the answer at 8:20. Good for you. Now, if you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Pacific University, presenting Molière's Tartuffe, directed by Joyce Maltby, on now through December 8th at the Paul and Vailu Theater. Schedule and tickets at hpu.edu/theater.
Moving on to how some modern students make their points. These days, poetry can get pretty raucous in a slam event. The pace is fast, the words are often improvised, and the competition is intense. It's not the verse we learned in school. Slam poetry is creating a whole new world for itself, one that high schoolers around Hawaii have grown up doing. It's a very competitive team event, reaching its annual peak in the Pacific Tongues Interscholastic Teen Grand Slam Competition this Saturday. Jason Mateo is one of the event's organizers. He's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Jason.
Hey, good morning. How's it going out there?
All right.
Aloha.
Give me a kind of a, if you would, Jason, kind of a working definition of slam poetry.
So slam poetry is a poetic competition where poets get an opportunity to perform an original poem. They get 3 minutes to get on the microphone, perform their piece. They get judged by 5 judges. Those judges judge them in an Olympic style, so they can give them a 7.5, a 9.1. The highest they can get is a 10. The lowest score, the highest score is dropped, so a poet can score the highest of a 30. And then they go through a certain amount of rounds, and at the end of the night, a cumulative point coins who is the champion.
I'm trying to picture how a poet could score an 8.6, you know? I mean, what are the criteria that you would apply?
Well, each judge is pretty different. But the criteria is based on content, presentation, performance, and even audience interaction. But at the end of the day, each judge is whatever they feel viscerally is what they're going to give the score to.
Are these are written pieces? They're not. Is there improvisation involved in this?
I think there's a level of improvisation, but for us, at Pacific Tongues, we hold a Wednesday workshop every Wednesday over at the Arts and Marks Garage, and what you see at a poetry slam is more of the final product. And even though the final product is an incredible experience to witness, for the young people who go through the process of creating that piece is really what we value the most. I think the process of what they want to say, how they're going to say it, the editing, how the piece comes about, the process of creating that piece is probably the most valuable part that we at Pacific Tongues really harness.
The way language is used, you think of poetry as being very, very considered language, you know, pieces that have been written, rewritten, every word weighed. Does that also apply to the works you're talking about here?
You know, our two main rules over at Pacific Tongues is that there's no wrong answers and the standard is yourself. And so we provide a safe space for young folks to be able to use their vernacular, the language that they know and the language that they're used to. And I think for us, this is a good way to engage our generation in literacy. And even though we're at a basic point of let's use your vernacular, I think that opens up the gates for kids who really take this opportunity or take this art form seriously. It opens up the gates to a huge world of literacy, from reading, writing, performing, listening, and teaching.
When you go beyond the vernacular, Jason, language gives you added tools that maybe your vernacular didn't. Do you agree with that?
What do you mean? Gives you added tools?
In the sense that a vernacular can't express all ideas, especially the more complex and subtle ideas, need nuances of language beyond slang, it seems to me. Do you agree?
I think that the opportunity to express yourself is a very and I'm gonna use the word lightly, but it's a very magical moment. I think that in a time where young people or even just people in general feel silenced, and they are given a space where they can express themselves, and not only just express themselves, but given a community that will listen, that will support, that will be part of that conversation. And I think that's the larger thing, is that they're part of a conversation.
Mm-hmm. What are the subjects that come up again and again? Do you have some recurring subject matter that you hear?
I think every generation has been. I think every generation has been different. Just this past Saturday, we had a presentation as part of TEDx Honolulu, and the young people who presented at that really wanted to communicate the responsibility to Hawaii, and I think that's been a really interesting conversation, not just for the young people who are Hawaiians, but the young people who are living in Hawaii, who are Pacific Islanders, and their relationship to Hawaii, and their responsibility and their accountability, their kuleana to the land.
So you're seeing a lot of that consciousness of the need to reconnect, yeah?
I think that there's a prevalent amount of young people who are asking themselves those kinds of questions. I think that there's also I think that also picks up on the categories of identity. Finding themselves, not necessarily just their relationship to Hawaii, but also their relationship to themselves and their families and their ancestors.
Are these what age group are you dealing with? Say up to what, 20 years old?
You know, we mainly deal with our program is targeted towards teenagers, mainly 13 to 19. However, we've had teenagers who have now, quote unquote, graduated from the organization, who are now interested in being leaders. Mm-hmm. And so our young people are, I guess now that we're reaching further more from like 25, our young people are continuing to engage with our program.
This is a living tradition that's going to be around, isn't it, Jason?
I'd say one more time, this is a living...
The living tradition, it seems as if it's really here to stay.
Yeah, you know, it's been here. I think that the oral tradition and spoken word is a continuum of that. I think that it hasn't disappeared. It just has it has now found a venue, and it has found a forum.
Seems
for
that way,
it to
Jason.
Thrive.
Jason, thanks very much for talking with us.
Jason, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Jason Mateo is one of the organizers of the Pacific Tongues Interscholastic Teen Grand Slam competition, now in its 7th year. That'll be Saturday night at Honolulu's Doris Duke Theater, and details are at hpr2.org.
On November 23rd, it's the Saloon Pilots bringing their bluegrass stylings to everything from traditional mountain tunes to the Grateful Dead. This special concert takes place in HPR's Atherton Studio November 23rd at 7:30. Tickets at 955-8821 during business hours or online at hprtickets.org.
There's purple clover, Queen Anne's lace, crimson hair across your face. You could make me cry if you don't know.
Today's show seemed to hover at the nexus of medicine and kids in a lot of ways. Not every conversation, but many of the conversations we had today.
And the new things, you would think the subject of youth had been studied to the point where we would have it nailed down, but it's always a shifting landscape. Yeah.
Well, and in response to what has happened over the last 30, 40 years, and those people who are now having kids, and looking at what really isn't working, plus the fact that the technology that we have now has so changed what we need to do as parents.
We're really getting some valuable perspectives from the people you've been talking to, yeah?
Well, that's sort of up to everybody else to make the determination in looking at it. But certainly, considering the point that we aren't doing as well by our girls or our boys as we would have liked to by this point, means that maybe we've got to take a much better look at how we are parenting our kids
Very
and teaching
likely.
Them.
Yeah.
That's going to do it for us for today. Up tomorrow, more on the nature and nurture of sexual identity. UH professor and researcher Dr. Ashley Maynard will be here.
And we'll talk to a young actor who's taking on the dark world of Edgar Allan Poe.
Meanwhile, you can talk back to your radio anytime you like. You can find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, tweet us at HI Conversation, or get to me at BecauseHPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, our links to more information, they're all in the archive on the HPR website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning right here for more of The Conversation. Have a good Monday.